Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Jamie Murdoch, and I'm delighted to have you with us as we tear through the week's most consequential global developments, cutting through the noise to get straight to the strategic insight.
And I'm Taylor Newhouse. My task today is to help us synthesize this vast and often conflicting source material. We are spanning continents and disciplines, moving from the battlefield to the balance sheet, ensuring we extract the deep, lasting implications of these global shifts.
Our source material this week offers a truly panoramic view, and we are announcing the deep dive title, The Economist, for the week of October 11th to 17th, 2025.
Quite a week to cover.
Absolutely. Our mission, as always, is to dissect everything from unprecedented, yet let's face it, fragile peace deals to intense internal political chaos across continents.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to explore the profound implications of these changes, especially concerning global trade, energy security, and long-term stability. Let's jump right into a story that just months ago seemed, well, impossible.
Agreed. We really have to start with the stunning conditional peace reached in the Middle East.
Okay, let's unpack phase one of the breakthrough in Gaza. So October 8th, 2 years after the massacre that triggered this whole conflict, Israel and Hamas reached a ceasefire agreement. Talks mediated in Egypt, right?
That's right. And this is being framed, importantly, as phase one of Donald Trump's highly ambitious 20-point peace plan.
And phase one, it seems, hinged on getting some very concrete things done immediately.
Exactly. Immediate deliverables were key. So the outcomes included the immediate release of all remaining Israeli hostages, both living and, tragically, the remains of those who died.
And in return?
In reciprocal action, Israel is releasing a large number of Palestinian prisoners. And crucially, the deal mandates a rapid surge of humanitarian aid into the Strip alongside the IDF pulling back to a designated yellow line position.
The yellow line. Okay.
These actions, despite the immense political complexity, were, you know, operational enough to implement pretty quickly.
But here's where it gets, well, really interesting, because phase two outlines the path forward, and it just looks like a terrifyingly high hurdle. It demands transformative change, doesn't it? Politically, militarily.
Oh, absolutely. Phase two demands nothing less than the comprehensive remaking of Gaza. It requires Hamas to fully disarm, basically ending its military control.
Which is huge in itself.
Massive. It also calls for creating a transitional sort of technocratic authority to take over civil governance and requires deploying a multinational peacekeeping force, likely backed by Arab states, to maintain security.
And only after all that.
Only after all those steps are achieved can long-term statehood talks even begin. It's an incredibly ambitious sequence.
The sticking point, though, even within these temporary agreements, it has to be the question of Israel's permanent security presence or, you know, lack thereof.
Precisely. That is the core conflict that has doomed so many prior peace efforts. And the language used in the Trump plan regarding the IDF withdrawal from the Strip is, well, deliberately vague.
How so?
It states the withdrawal will be based on standards, milestones, and timeframes linked to demilitarization.
Which sounds like?
It sounds like, and effectively is, a conditional veto for Israel.
And that sounds like a condition that Prime Minister Netanyahu is already jumping on, given his public statement that Israel will remain deep inside the Strip for the foreseeable future, even after this phase begins.
That public declaration is absolutely critical because it signals to Hamas and the Palestinian Authority that the ultimate goal, full Israeli withdrawal, isn't guaranteed. And that just undermines the trust they'd need to actually agree to disarm.
And the trauma, the sheer scale of destruction.
It complicates this exponentially. Think about it. An estimated 78% of Gaza's buildings damaged or destroyed. That physical devastation mirrors the loss of faith on both sides. There was a poll back in May suggesting, shockingly, that 50% of Palestinians supported the October 7th attacks.
Half. Wow. Yet despite this deep division, this trauma, there are some legitimate grounds for hope embedded within the agreement's context.
There are. I'd point to three main anchors for, let's call it, optimism. First, the political landscape in Israel itself. The end of the war, regardless of how this deal plays out, has accelerated political pressure on Netanyahu.
You think he might actually leave office?
Analysts suggest he might be out within 12 months. That could fracture his coalition with the hard right parties, potentially opening the door to a more moderate government, one perhaps willing to accept a full security guaranteed withdrawal.
Okay, so that's one. What's the second?
Second, the shifting geopolitics. Specifically, the humbling of Iran and the alignment of the Gulf states with the Abraham Accords framework.
Right. Trump's pressure, Iran weakened.
Yes. President Trump's willingness to exert pressure on both sides, combined with the perception that Iran and its regional proxies have been significantly weakened, it creates a regional security environment that feels less immediately volatile.
And the third anchor.
Third, and arguably the most concrete sign of commitment, is the money.
The reconstruction money. That $53 billion estimate.
That figure comes from the World Bank. And the crucial element here is the willingness of Gulf Arab states, specifically Saudi Arabia and the UAE, to underwrite that massive reconstruction effort.
And maybe even provide peacekeepers.
Potentially provide the manpower for the multinational peacekeeping force, yes. They are willing to pay for stability, provided that investment isn't immediately, you know, destroyed in another war.
So it creates a powerful economic incentive for everyone in the region.
Exactly. To ensure Phase 2 succeeds, building a regional structure based on economic cooperation rather than immediate conflict.
That focus on conflict and stability provides a crucial bridge, actually, to other geopolitical hotspots. Because the conflict in Ukraine isn't easing. In fact, the tempo of strategic attacks against Russian energy infrastructure seems to be accelerating quite dramatically.
Ukraine has certainly moved past just isolated counterstrikes. They seem engaged in a systematic campaign aimed right at Russia's economic capacity to wage war.
How frequent are these attacks now?
We're seeing reports of 4 to 5 deep strike drone attacks per week on refineries and fuel distribution networks. And intelligence suggests Kyiv is pushing towards a daily operational tempo.
Wow, daily. What's the specific strategic target? It sounds like they're aiming for maximum long-term damage, not just, you know, temporary disruption.
They are targeting the most sophisticated and expensive components, the high-cost cracking units.
Explain those a bit.
Sure. These specialized units take crude oil and break it down into higher-margin products, things like high-octane petrol, diesel, jet fuel, basically the profitable stuff.
And the impact.
Well, unconfirmed reports suggest up to 40% of Russia's total oil refining capacity has been affected at various points, with maybe about 20% down at any given time.
And the real difficulty is replacing those cracking units under sanctions.
Exactly. These components are produced almost exclusively in the West, making them basically irreplaceable for the foreseeable future.
So Russia can still sell crude.
Right. They can continue to export lower margin crude oil, but their ability to sell the lucrative refined products which generate crucial foreign exchange earnings is being severely curtailed. Sir Lawrence Friedman, the British strategist, he points out that the sheer dispersal of these targets over Russia's massive territory makes the campaign virtually impossible for Moscow to stop.
It fundamentally erodes the Kremlin's sense of security.
Absolutely. The war is undeniably coming home for them.
And while discussing the grim reality of this war, we have to briefly acknowledge the reports revealed by our sources concerning the Ukrainian captives held in Russia.
Yes, the detailing of systemic and widespread torture, described as worse than the worst horror film.
It's chilling. A necessary detail, though, that reflects the radicalized ideological nature that seems to be permeating the Russian state's approach to the conflict now.
It speaks volumes about the ideological foundation upon which the conflict is being waged and sustained. It goes far beyond traditional military objectives.
Let's pivot now to the global South and this phenomenon of the new African big man. We're seeing a pattern where entrenched strongman rule is being mimicked by a new, younger generation of autocrats replacing the older guard.
This is a worrying regression, definitely. You see the template set by figures like Paul Biya of Cameroon. He's 92, been in power for 43 years.
Incredible.
But now, younger leaders, Felix Tshisekedi in the DRC or the Sahel juntas, they're adopting that template, bypassing term limits, centralizing power.
And the data suggests this centralization actually comes with diminishing returns for the national economy.
Absolutely. Initially, leaders in places like Ivory Coast, Rwanda, Uganda, they often show faster economic growth than the sub-Saharan average. But the moment those leaders bypass constitutional term limits, the trend reverses.
So longer tenure means slower growth.
Strongly associated with it, yes. Along with rampant corruption, election rigging, and channeling state patronage to increasingly narrow groups, often based on ethnic ties or family.
The example from the Republic of Congo paints that picture vividly. A 10-hour, bumpy drive from the capital to the leader's hometown, Oyo, all in darkness.
Until you get 10 kilometers outside Oyo, and suddenly the streetlights start working. That's the physical, undeniable manifestation of concentrated power and patronage at the expense of national development.
And this political environment is precisely where global energy giants, specifically Total Energies, are choosing to double down.
Yeah, TotalEnergies is leading a major dash for new African oil and gas reserves.
They're positioning themselves as the biggest player.
The largest supermajor player in the region, it seems. Focusing on huge new reserves in quite volatile environments like Uganda, Mozambique, Tanzania. TotalEnergies currently gets nearly a fifth of its hydrocarbon production from sub-Saharan Africa, and they plan to add another, 374,000 barrels per day equivalent through these new projects.
But operating in this environment, it must create significant ethical and, frankly, practical security challenges given the instability you just described.
It does. These projects are highly controversial. In Uganda, for instance, activists opposing that massive 1,443-kilometer pipeline to the sea are reportedly being bullied into silence, raising severe human rights concerns.
In Mozambique?
There, TotalEnergies is relying on security provided by Rwandan soldiers just to continue operations despite unpredictable militant attacks. The company is clearly prioritizing long-term energy security and returns over climate or human rights risks. It really illustrates the stark economic forces at play when global demand meets regional autocracy.
That focus on global energy and political volatility provides a crucial bridge to our next major theme: the radical domestic and international changes being driven by the current U.S. administration. Welcome, it seems, to Zero Migration America.
Indeed. Donald Trump has declared a massive political victory at the southern border. The migrant encounters, as they call them, have plummeted to the lowest levels in decades.
And net migration.
Expected to be near zero for 2025, potentially even negative, a demographic event we haven't seen since the depths of the Great Depression.
There's that symbol of this shift, Friendship Park, where the U.S. side is empty, militarized, while the Mexican side is bustling with activity and commerce. It tells the story visually. But politically successful or not, what is the profound economic shock of this Zero Migration America?
The shock is multifaceted and deep. America will inevitably become smaller, poorer, and demonstrably less innovative. We often focus on the physical labor shortage. You know, over half of farm workers are migrants, a quarter of construction workers.
Oh, that visible impact.
But the real structural damage comes from choking off the skilled migration routes.
Like the aggressive targeting of H-1B visas.
Exactly. The administration is floating the potential imposition of a, wait for it, $100,000 fee for H-1B applications.
$100,000.
Per application. That cost is brutal and economically unfeasible, particularly for the research track used by universities, hospitals, postdocs. These are individuals whose salaries simply cannot absorb that kind of fee, even though their work yields massive, high-leverage economic benefits and innovation.
What's the estimated impact?
Analysts estimate this fee alone could shrink the H-1B visa route by around 30%. And you have to remember, four of the seven CEOs of the Magnificent Seven tech companies were born abroad and came to the U.S. through these exact skilled worker channels.
So the long-term damage.
To America's productivity, innovation, pipelines, fiscal stability. It'll be persistent and very slow to heal.
Okay, so given this isolationism and the wide-ranging Liberation Day tariffs imposed earlier this year, many economists predicted the U.S. economy would be in freefall by now. Why is the picture surprisingly rosy, with growth nearing 4% in the second quarter?
It's a kind of levy paradox, really, due largely to two factors. First, the tariffs were actually gentler than initially feared. The average effective tariff rate is closer to 11% right now, not the 28% ceiling the market was bracing for. That's due to various rollbacks, corporate reclassifications.
Okay, so less bite than expected.
And second, there's been high corporate absorption of costs and, frankly, quite a bit of non-compliance, which softened the immediate inflationary blow.
But here's the crucial counterforce at work, where it gets really interesting. The U.S. stock market boom.
This is the economic engine that's currently insulating the U.S. from a tariff-induced recession. The phenomenal AI-fueled stock market boom, the S&P 500, is up a staggering 40% since its trough back in April. It's generating a powerful wealth effect.
Explain that effect.
Wealthier households see their portfolios expand, they feel more financially secure, and subsequently they increase their consumption spending. This consumer confidence is effectively propping up overall GDP growth, projected at a respectable 1.5% to 2% for 2025. This stock market surge is acting as a massive temporary economic counterweight to the immediate recessionary drag from tariffs and zero migration.
This isn't free, right? This economic insulation is paid for through rising prices for ordinary Americans.
Absolutely correct. Our data indicates the administration's tariffs are currently boosting the underlying consumer price index, CPI, by about 0.3 percentage points. And that inflation is projected to climb toward 3.5% around the turn of the year.
And that hits poorer households hardest.
Disproportionately hits them, yes, as they spend a higher share of their income on essential imported goods, Moreover, rising inflation puts the stock market boom itself at risk by deterring the Federal Reserve from cutting interest rates further. It's a precarious balance.
Shifting to domestic political strategy, the grinding government shutdown is now into its second week, and the Republicans seem to be using it as a deliberate weapon.
The architect of this strategy is apparently Russell Vought, the director of the Office of Management and Budget. The strategy is to exploit the shutdown by threatening mass federal worker layoffs, formal reductions in force.
Targeting specific agencies.
Targeting agencies that receive discretionary funding and are not seen as aligned with the president's priorities.
And the most potent threat seems to be denying back pay, which has traditionally been guaranteed after a shutdown ends.
Exactly. Vought has publicly claimed that the 750,000 furloughed federal workers may not be entitled to automatic back pay once the shutdown ends. This is a massive escalation.
Designed to maximize pain.
To maximize political pain and force concessions from Democrats, even though polling consistently shows independents blame Republicans more the longer the shutdown drags on, it's a high-risk gamble.
And this strategy of trade war and political pain is having some unexpected consequences for the administration's own base, particularly American soya farmers.
Oh, the misery is palpable, especially in the Midwest. China has retaliated against U.S. tariffs by imposing a crippling 20% duty on American soya.
And orders.
Zero new orders since mid-September, effectively freezing out almost a quarter of the entire U.S. crop.
Ouch. And the trade war always creates unintended winners. In this case, it's Brazil.
Brazil's soya farmers are absolutely ebullient. They have cemented their position as the global soybean superpower by capitalizing directly on this rift. Brazil's exports are projected to hit 110 million tons in 2025, wholly offsetting any losses they might incur from U.S. tariffs on other Brazilian goods.
And the critical implication here is permanence, isn't it?
Very likely. Having been burnt by unpredictable tariffs twice now, both American farmers and Chinese buyers are likely to restructure their supply chains permanently. That ensures long-term dependence on Brazil.
This political climate seems driven by a strong voter appetite for retribution among some. We have fascinating polling from YouGov The Economist on the administration's revenge agenda.
The polling is really striking because it highlights a deep division. While independents overwhelmingly dislike the revenge agenda, the Republican base actively supports it.
What's the most shocking detail?
Well, over a third of polled Republicans supported the clearly unconstitutional idea of deporting American citizens who disagree with the president.
Deporting citizens?
Yes. Policies like sending the National Guard into defiant cities or investigating political opponents were supported by margins up to 65 points among Republicans. It shows a real desire for political payback within that base.
And we saw this retribution manifested, arguably, in the controversial Operation Midway Blitz immigration raid in Chicago.
That operation was defined by its use of force and, well, theatrical flair. There were reports of an airborne assault on an apartment complex.
And citizens caught up in it.
An American citizen, Alicia Brooks, described being zip-tied and handcuffed by officers despite asserting her citizenship. But what's crucial here, according to the analysis, is the objective. The primary goal wasn't traditional law enforcement. It was the generation of Hollywood-style video content for political messaging.
The content is the message.
Exactly. The sight of Border Patrol boats prowling the Chicago River downtown, filmed by professional in-house videographers, it was designed to convey a sense of pervasive federal domination. Political theater disguised as enforcement intended to create viral, powerful imagery showing federal authority can reach anywhere.
This radical shift in American policy has forced its closest neighbor, Canada, into a major strategic rethinking. Prime Minister Mark Carney seems to be calling for a permanent rupture in U.S.-Canada relations.
Carney's visit to the White House was ultimately fruitless in ending the existing U.S. tariffs on Canadian steel, cars, aluminum, and his long-term conclusion is radical and quite sobering. The multi-decade process of steady integration with the United States is, in his words, over.
Over.
Permanently.
That's the view. Canada must adapt to a permanently protectionist American neighbor.
So what does that long-run strategy of adaptation look like for Canada?
It seems to have two prongs. Domestically, Carney plans a massive infrastructure and housing boom aiming to double home building, fuel investment by canceling a planned capital gains tax rise, simplifying regulation, trying to build domestic resilience.
And internationally.
Internationally, the plan is dramatic diversification.
Whoa.
Seeking to bridge two of the world's largest trade blocs, the European Union and the CPTPP. Carney seems to believe Canada can generate greater net gains by leveraging these international relationships than the U.S. can strip away through bilateral trade restrictions. A big pivot. That sets the stage perfectly for a look at the world's other economic superpower, China, and its centralized and apparently very costly drive for technological supremacy.
China's entire economic course is being mapped out right now for the upcoming 15th five-year plan covering 2026 to 2030, and it's a plan personally shaped and dictated by Xi Jinping.
And the core focus?
Doubling down on high-end manufacturing and securing technological leadership. We're talking about humanoid robots, quantum computing, integrating AI into 90% of manufacturing processes by 2030. It's all about state-led tech dominance.
But to sustain healthy, balanced growth, China desperately needs to boost domestic consumption. It's stuck at only 57% of GDP compared to a global average of 73%.
That's the big dilemma.
And economists argue this requires building a better social safety net to encourage saving less and spending more. But that runs directly counter to Mr. Xi's ideology, doesn't it?
It does. Mr. Xi has repeatedly espoused this anti-welfarism stance, warning that overly generous governments create lazy people and undermine personal responsibility.
So a big fiscal injection into the safety net is unlikely.
Very unlikely because of that ideological constraint. The likely compromise will be, you know, vague targets demanding disposable incomes rise faster than GDP growth, perhaps rather than addressing the structural reason people oversave. Fear of medical costs, lack of sufficient retirement safety nets, they're prioritizing ideology over the practical market-based economic solution.
And what's absolutely fascinating here is the sheer measurable cost of this centralized industrial policy. It sounds like staggering inefficiency costing hundreds of billions.
That's right. An IMF paper estimated that China's massive industrial policies, all the subsidies, tax breaks, cheap credit funneled into priority sectors, resulted in an eye-watering $370 billion a year in lost economic output.
Lost output how?
Due to resource misallocation and gross overproduction, it's equivalent to 2% of China's GDP just gone, wasted.
How does that misallocation actually manifest on the ground?
It's seen most clearly in what the Chinese call involution, this relentless, meaningless competition where companies are forced to race to the bottom because the market is just oversaturated.
Examples.
Think of the vicious price wars between subsidized EV makers or the redundancy in chip manufacturing capacity where dozens of firms are producing marginally different products just to access state funding. They are achieving certain technological goals, yes, but at a huge direct cost to the national economy in terms of efficiency and profitability.
And this expensive strategy is also generating significant internal friction, particularly regarding their attempts to attract foreign skilled talent to fill these high-tech roles.
China introduced its new K visa scheme, basically their version of the U.S. H-1B visa designed to attract international professionals. Looks good internationally, perhaps?
But domestically?
It has caused fury domestically, with youth unemployment stuck near 18.9%. Young Chinese graduates see foreign talent not as an asset, but as unwanted competition. The online comments are scathing, very nationalist. Lines like, "We can't even use up our own country's talent. Is foreign talent so great?"
A classic authoritarian dilemma.
Absolutely. This conflict between national technological ambition and domestic social stability.
Adding to the gloom for anyone operating in the Chinese market is the increasingly sinister corporate environment you mentioned earlier.
Corporate leaders are under immense, unprecedented pressure. It's driven by detentions, opaque court rulings, and even a notable recent spate of suicides. The extrajudicial Liuzia detention system.
Where they can be held secretly.
Yes. Suspects can be held secretly without access to lawyers. That system saw 39 listed company bosses detained by September, already exceeding last year's record. It signals that the entire business network, from private tycoon to state official, is now under intense centralized scrutiny.
And the use of the credit blacklist has surged as a means of punishment and pressure.
The credit blacklist is notorious for pressuring debtors, where bankruptcy laws are underdeveloped, but its use has just exploded. Over 200,000 people were added to the list this year alone, compared to maybe 17,400 back in 2019.
And what does it do?
It bans high consumption, no flying, no high-speed trains, no fancy hotels. And it's now being deployed against major tycoons like Wang Jianlin, demonstrating the state's absolute control over citizens' financial and personal movement.
This idea of absolute control extends right down to the street level through what the sources call God's eye view governance.
This is China's grid management system. It's a mechanism that uses digital surveillance, centralized monitoring screens, to track every resident, breaking villages and city blocks into tiny units.
The goal is efficiency, but the function is control.
Exactly. Grid attendants track and monitor at-risk individuals, the destitute, the mentally ill, drug users, others labeled troublemakers in real time. Officials boast that small problems shouldn't leave the village.
And the danger.
The real danger is how this technology adds this pervasive, inescapable layer of control. It forces attendants to conduct monthly checks on these at-risk individuals, blurring social services with political suppression, and fundamentally eroding personal freedom.
This issue of centralized management brings us naturally to India, another rising superpower attempting to grapple with governance challenges, specifically in its rapidly expanding urban centers. Bangalore, or Bengaluru, is attempting an ambitious experiment to fix its notorious urban gridlock.
Bangalore, India's Silicon Valley, suffers from colossal maladministration. It's due to fragmentation and excessive state control. So they're restructuring the city's massive municipal corporation into five smaller entities, all overseen by a new Greater Bengaluru Authority, or GBA.
The hope being decentralization fixes the gridlock.
That's the idea. By decentralizing administration, they hope to finally solve the gridlock caused by countless unwieldy state-level authorities managing water, transport, planning with little coordination.
But restructuring governance in India is politically fraught, often ends up in court.
Absolutely. The biggest risk is a legal challenge. Critics argue the GBA structure violates parts of the 1992 constitutional amendment designed to empower urban local bodies.
So it's co-paradox.
It is. State governments are extremely reluctant to voluntarily hand over power to cities. So this politically risky, centralized reorganization might be the only realistic way to improve urban governance under India's current constitutional constraints.
Speaking of ambitious goals, Prime Minister Modi has set an economic target of achieving a $10 trillion economy by 2047. Our sources suggest this is a dawdle. Why is that target insufficient?
It's insufficient because, well, given forecast real currency appreciation, India's economy is expected to hit $6.8 trillion by 2030 anyway. So hitting $10 trillion by 2047 is easily achievable and, frankly, a bit paltry as a target.
So what's a better measure?
A better measure of national success and prosperity would be aiming for high income status, measured by real GDP per person. To reach, say, Bulgaria's current standard of living, about $41,000 PPP adjusted India would need sustained 6% annual real growth over the next two decades. Now, that is a truly bold target, reflecting fundamental national transformation.
We also have fascinating insight into India's social landscape from the book, Why the Poor Don't Kill Us. It addresses the specific anxieties of the urban middle class.
The book suggests that the elites focus on potential violence from their domestic servants, maids, drivers is a massive category error.
A category error.
Meaning they're worrying about the wrong group. Those service workers are now largely solidified in the lower middle class by local standards. The real source of social instability and anxiety, the bitterness that should worry the government, comes from the far larger, newly educated and expectant middle class.
What are they angry about?
They are angry about shoddy infrastructure, entrenched corruption, and most critically, the severe shortage of suitable jobs for the millions of young graduates pouring out of universities every year. That's the true social instability risk that needs to be addressed.
From India's social contract, let's jump across to Europe, where political turmoil seems to be the main export these days. France is currently mired in a chaotic political crisis.
The week in French politics was described as chaotic, farcical, and unseemly. The rapid resignation and then subsequent return of Sebastien Lecornu as caretaker prime minister just highlighted the paralyzing deadlock in their deeply divided parliament.
Macron needs to break the deadlock somehow.
Desperately. He needs a mechanism to buy time and break this deadlock before it paralyzes his final years in office.
What concessions might Macron have to make to secure that stability? What's the price?
The price could be high. Lecornu himself hinted at potential concessions designed to placate the left and center-left, things like a full parliamentary debate on suspending the highly unpopular 2023 pension reform, or potentially even introducing a new tax on the super rich.
He has to stabilize things, especially with Le Pen polling so high.
Exactly. Marine Le Pen's national rally, RN, is polling dangerously high, leading voting intentions at 33-34%. If Macron is forced to dissolve parliament, the RN could come perilously close to securing an absolute majority. High stakes.
Across Central Europe, in the Czech Republic, we see the return of the populist figure, Andrej Babiš.
His populist ANO party won the parliamentary election, signaling his highly probable return as prime minister. Hmm. However, forming a coalition presents massive hurdles.
Who does he need?
He requires the support of radical, hardline, anti-EU parties like the Motorists for Themselves and the fractious SPD. The SPD is openly anti-EU and anti-NATO.
So that raises concerns.
Severe concerns. The mere prospect of such an alliance raises worries over the country's foreign policy direction, its commitment to supporting Ukraine, and its compliance with the EU's flagship Green Deal environmental policies.
Moving to Britain, the Conservative Party's annual conference was characterized by, well, a search for identity, with leadership looking to the radical Milei model from Argentina for inspiration.
Kimi Badenoch, the Tory leader, explicitly framed Javier Milei as the template for the party's future. The mood was distinctly Milei-esque, focusing heavily on fierce cultural battles. Badenoch notably denounced the post-colonial theorist Frantz Fanon.
Right, the culture war stuff.
And severe fiscal discipline, using the chainsaw analogy popularized by Milei. This is a deliberate, high-risk attempt to appeal to the hard right of the electorate, despite the fact that Milei's own libertarian experiment in Argentina is currently, well, highly volatile.
Does the public actually support the core economic tenet of fiscal discipline? The cuts?
Numerically, they do. Polling shows Britons massively prefer spending cuts over tax hikes by a margin of 64% to 23% to cover the predicted public finance shortfall, which is somewhere between $18 billion and $28 billion.
So the Tories still have some economic credibility.
They retain some trust on economic management, yes. But Badenoch's political acumen is heavily questioned, given her focus on these lofty, abstract culture wars rather than the immediate, pressing economic concerns facing average voters.
And this political instability is happening against the backdrop of post-Brexit Britain suffering significant trade collateral damage. The steel industry seems like a clear example of this post-Brexit vulnerability.
It truly is the poster child for trade isolation. The British steel industry has been hit first by the persistent 25% U.S. tariffs and now faces a devastating proposed 50% EU tariff on anything beyond a halved quota.
50%.
50. Given that the EU accounts for 80% of British steel exports, this is potentially catastrophic. It clearly demonstrates the vulnerability of being outside major trade blocs in an age of rising global protectionism.
Why is Britain treated this way by its former partners, though?
It seems to be about being categorized as a rival, not an ally. Countries like Norway or even Ukraine often get generous special trade treatment from the EU because they aren't viewed as significant industrial competitors trying to undercut EU markets.
But Britain is seen differently.
Britain, as a major manufacturing and industrial economy, is perceived as a rival, which means it receives the full hard force of trade protectionism, exacerbating its exposure.
We must also address the rise in anti-Semitism, tragically punctuated by the Manchester synagogue attack on Yom Kippur, which killed two people.
Sir David Omand, the UK's former counterterrorism coordinator, framed the fight against extremism and protecting communities as an urgent security imperative, and the data is alarming.
What does this show?
Britain saw over 1,500 anti-Semitic incidents in just the first half of 2025. In America, that figure was over 9,000 incidents in 2024.
9,000.
The fundamental concern is this delicate, dangerous balance between the necessary, visible police protection coordinated with the Community Security Trust, CST, and the fear that unchallenged, menacing slogans and ambient hate at large, pro-Palestinian rallies, inspire these dangerous lone wolf attacks.
The community's decision to refuse to curtail Jewish life, though, that's a powerful form of resistance against this ambient threat.
It is the ultimate pushback. The Manchester attack was a profound shock because the UK actually has a strong track record of preventing complex, multi-person terror plots. Mm-hmm. But the sheer volume of low-level incidents just increases the probability of a lone wolf slipping through.
So the community fights back.
By making security paramount for every event, but refusing to let fear stop them from living normally, it's incredibly brave.
Okay, for a brief reprieve, let's celebrate a truly British institution. We can explore the success of the J.D. Wetherspoon pub chain and what founder Tim Martin understands about the British pub landscape.
Tim Martin achieved enormous success through a potent combination of, well, economic populism and ruthless corporate consistency. His model is built on massive scale and undeniable value. You can get pints for as little as £2.10 in London, for instance.
Incredible value.
Despite the chain's image sometimes suffering from Martin's outspoken politics, Wetherspoon's pubs are this uniquely corporate approximation of the family gathering place.
How do they manage that feel?
They expertly blend that consistency, you know, the menu, the prices, with unique local flavor. It's exemplified by the bespoke carpets in every single pub. They often reflect local history and legend, fostering this paradoxical sense of intimacy within a huge chain. Quite clever, really.
Let's pivot back to security, specifically Europe's defense identity crisis. The sources say the abandonment scenario, the U.S. pulling back, is now a serious, formal part of defense planning.
Yes. The possibility of a rapid, comprehensive pullback of U.S. forces is no longer a fringe fear. It's a central strategic planning scenario in Brussels and European capitals. Trump administration officials like Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of War, have unequivocally stated that America will defend its homeland first.
Implying Europe needs to step up.
Strongly implying that Europe must shoulder more of the burden for its own defense. This is the structural consequence of decades of Europe basically outsourcing its security to the U.S.
And the problem is, Europe currently has the wrong kind of forces for homeland defense.
Precisely. This is the deep strategic error of the last 30 years. European nations spent decades investing almost exclusively in light, agile expeditionary units designed for peacekeeping or fighting insurgents in places like Afghanistan and Iraq.
Why did they do that?
It was a political decision, really, intended to maintain good relations and operational alignment with America. Now, facing a potential threat from a traditional 19th century style great power like Russia, they are severely ill-equipped for heavy, high-intensity homeland defense.
Ireland's upcoming presidential election provides a perfect microcosm of this identity crisis, doesn't it?
Ireland, with its history of neutrality, is currently grappling with this new reality. The debate ahead of the October 24th election pits preserving traditional neutrality, advocated by the leading candidate, Catherine Connolly, against the urgent need to raise the country's, frankly, pitiful defense budget.
And reform the triple lock law.
And crucially, reform the triple lock law. That law requires UN Security Council approval for overseas troop deployments, which basically paralyzes rapid response. This debate is underpinned by the real fear of Russian naval ships prowling the coast.
Which highlights the absurdity.
Of a country with a tiny army and no fighter jets debating neutrality in this new geopolitical reality, it's stark.
Okay, let's transition now to innovation and culture, starting with the staggering centralization of power and investment around one single AI company. OpenAI. We almost have to perform the thought experiment. What if OpenAI went belly up?
To gauge its centrality, you just have to look at the money. The sheer scale of announced chip deals is dizzying. $10 billion in custom chip deals with Broadcom, up to $100 billion from NVIDIA, and a similar $90 billion deal with AMD over the next few years.
That's over $250 billion.
Over $250 billion in commitments linked directly to building out OpenAI's infrastructure. Its models, like Sora 2, are being called zero-shot reasoners. For vision, meaning they can successfully solve visual tasks they were never explicitly trained for.
That functionality suggests they're becoming fundamental general-purpose models. And that level of investment gives Sam Altman, the boss, almost godlike influence over the technology supply chain.
It does. The announcement of just the Broadcom deal instantly added nearly $200 billion to Broadcom's market value. The concentration of power is immense.
But OpenAI failed.
Analysts generally agree the damage would be localized to those direct partners and investors. The AI revolution itself probably wouldn't stop. Competitors like Google and Meta would likely scoop up the talent and gain market share, assuming the failure was structural or financial, not, you know, a fundamental flaw in the tech itself. Arguably, NVIDIA remains more central to the AI boom than OpenAI itself.
Now for the culture side of AI, X-rated AI country songs, we're seeing bots generating viral, deliberately outlandish music.
This is a consumer-driven content revolution powered by models like Beats by AI. Users input prompts, often deliberately X-rated or politically incorrect, specifically to defy the highly conservative genre tropes of Nashville country music.
And AI generates everything.
Instantly generates lyrics, vocals, instrumentation. But this content boom has a severe dark side, data fraud.
How does that work?
Fraudsters are slopping into the ecosystem, as the source puts it, by generating millions of generic, low-quality tracks just to collect tiny, cumulative royalty payments. Platforms like Spotify have been forced to purge a staggering 75 million AI-generated songs. It shows the profound challenge of fraud in this new content economy.
Next, let's talk transport. Forget the focus on electric cars for a moment. Cycling seems to be revolutionizing transport in major cities, and it's leading to a visible culture war.
Cycling is genuinely disruptive. In the city of London, cyclists now outnumber cars 2.1 during peak hours, and they've surpassed motorists across central Paris.
What's fueling the boom?
Massive investment in safe, separated, bike-friendly infrastructure and the rise of e-bikes. E-bikes make riding accessible to people who don't want to break a sweat, regardless of hills or distance. It broadens the appeal massively.
So what does this all mean politically? Why does safer infrastructure lead to conflict?
Because road space is often viewed as a zero-sum game. Creating protected bike lanes usually requires taking space away from car parking or driving lanes, which immediately polarizes voters.
And politicians jump on it.
Populist figures like Nigel Farage and Richard Holden are capitalizing on the war on cars rhetoric, making car ownership and use a key political dividing line. Furthermore, this boom is threatened by the rise of illegal fast e-bikes used by delivery riders.
The ones that go too fast.
Often modified to far exceed legal speed limits. They increase accidents and risk poisoning the boom by turning public opinion against cycling infrastructure generally. It's a tricky side effect.
Let's shift to geopolitical gaming. Saudi Arabia is making a massive bid to become a video game superpower.
This is a colossal soft power and economic play. The recent acquisition of Electronic Arts, EA, for $55 billion by the PIF-led group is the undeniable crown jewel of their $38 billion war chest earmarked just for the gaming sector.
And their strategy.
It's comprehensive. Acquiring major developers like Scopely and Embracer, dominating esports, they already control 40% of the global market, apparently, and using gaming as a highly effective soft power projection tool.
And the potential for content influence is already evident in the game designs themselves.
Absolutely. The upcoming Assassin's Creed update is set in Al Ula, a historic city the Saudis are heavily promoting for tourism. It shows how Saudi money can subtly influence content and narrative.
The goal is
acquire the intellectual property, stoke fan engagement globally, and use their own rich history as a source of worldwide appealing content, projecting a different, more modern image of the kingdom.
Let's quickly review the 2025 Nobel Prizes for the curious learner among you. What were the big takeaways in science this year, starting with chemistry?
In chemistry, the prize recognized Kitagawa, Robson, and Yagi for their work on metal organic frameworks, or MOFs.
Okay.
The best way to visualize them is as hotels for chemicals. They're extremely porous, crystalline materials with vast internal surface areas. MOF5, for example, achieves nearly 3,000 square meters of surface area per gram.
Wow. And the use.
Makes them ideal for applications like highly efficient CO2 capture, hydrogen storage for clean energy, and even the precise caging and release of pharmaceutical drugs within the body. Really versatile stuff.
Okay. And in medicine?
The Medicine Prize honored Brunkow, Ramsdell, and Sakaguchi for their identification and characterization of regulatory T cells, or TREGs.
TREGs.
These are essentially the immune system's police force. Their primary job is to control and suppress other immune responses, basically preventing the body from attacking itself.
Crucial for autoimmune diseases.
Absolutely vital for developing new treatments for autoimmune diseases like type 1 diabetes and rheumatoid arthritis, and also for enhancing cancer immunotherapies by figuring out how to manage them.
Finally, physics.
Physics recognized Clark, Martinez, and Devaray for their fundamental work on quantum tunneling at scale. This research bridges the complex gap between pure quantum mechanics and practical computing.
Wow.
By enabling the reliable creation of qubits, the foundational components necessary for future quantum computers, really paving the way.
Moving to deep data insights, New York City is having surprising success in its fight against rodents.
Rats, yes. This is a great example of common sense and good management actually triumphing. The city mandated containerization rat-resistant bins with lids for 70% of buildings as part of a strict data-driven program.
So ditching the black bags.
Exactly. This shift from soft, chewable garbage bags to secure containers is leading to demonstrably dropping rat sightings. New York is now kind of a model for cities like Washington, D.C. and Boston, which have seen rising complaints due to poor management and relying on outdated cheap bin systems. Sometimes the simple solutions work.
Let's shift focus now to what you called earlier the unsexy but dangerous risk on a balance sheet. Receivables.
Receivables, the money owed to a company by its customers, might sound dull, but they have played a key, often understated role in almost every major financial blow-up. Think Carillion, Sunbeam, Enron.
Why are they so risky?
Because rising receivables often mask fundamental fraud or business strain. Auditors struggle to scrutinize the reality behind those money-owed figures, making them ripe for manipulation. It's easier to book fake revenue than fake cash.
And what is the modern danger related to receivables on a massive systemic scale?
The systemic risk is China's local government financing vehicles, or LGFVs. These vehicles were used to fund China's massive infrastructure boom over the last decade or so.
Then they're receivables.
The receivables held by these LGFVs now total a massive $3.2 trillion. That's equivalent to 17% of China's entire GDP.
Why is this internal debt so dangerous compared to, say, private sector debt?
Because the money is owed largely by the local governments themselves. This creates a deeply dangerous circular debt structure where the ultimate debtor and the ultimate creditor are both governmental entities.
So if the local governments can't pay?
If those local governments, many of whom are already in perilous financial positions, cannot make good on those obligations, this internal circular debt poses a massive multi-trillion-dollar potential blow-up risk to the entire Chinese financial system. It's basically debt owed to itself that may never actually be repaid. A huge hidden vulnerability.
Finally, let's turn to cultural and historical reflections, starting with the passing of Jilly Cooper, the Bonkbuster Queen.
Cooper was a real cultural phenomenon, wasn't she? Celebrated for her books that were, yes, smutty, admittedly often sexist by today's standards, but enormously popular because, as many readers said, they simply cheered people up.
A chronicler of her time.
Definitely. Transitioning from writing about the early social revolution, dirty sinks, domestic life, to purveying manuals for the subsequent sexual revolution, she had that rare ability to achieve massive sales while literary critics often, you know, sniffed at her work.
And the reaction to her death.
Including The Sun's front page headline, "Romp in Peace, Jilly," really speaks to her lasting legacy as a beloved national and often scandalous figure.
We also have Mark Mazur's important biography of anti-Semitism, focusing on the very meaning of the word itself.
Mazur explores the complexity and evolution of anti-Semitism. The term itself was coined relatively late, in 1879, by Wilhelm Marr, specifically to underscore the supposed foreign origin of Jews, divorcing it from traditional religious hostility and framing it more as a political conspiracy theory.
And the sources highlight the post-1967 shift.
Crucially, yes. How post-1967 American Jews' identification with the State of Israel grew profoundly, blurring the line between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. This remains a core and frankly painful contemporary debate.
Because for many American Jews,
anti-Zionism, regardless of whether or not it explicitly advocates violence, is viewed as an existential attack on themselves, on their identity. It's a deeply complex issue.
We'll conclude this section with the emotional story of Jane Goodall's life and legacy.
Goodall, who passed away recently, spent her entire life urging humans to honor animals and the natural world. The core emotional moment that seemed to define her later life was that embrace she shared with the rescued chimpanzee Wunda back in 2013.
It's a powerful image.
A moment of profound, wordless connection she never forgot. Her work was a continual, simple reminder of the deep similarities between chimps and humans, but also of the difference. Humans possess language, which should have made us wise stewards of nature, but often hasn't.
And her message?
Her simple, powerful, and hopeful message remains that each day, each of us should just do something to make the world better, a fitting legacy.
We have covered an enormous, almost overwhelming scope today. From the delicate conditional peace in Gaza and the collapse of international integration thinking in Canada, to the high-tech, expensive drive for supremacy in China and the political crises gripping Europe. It really feels like a moment defined by rapid, often chaotic global shifts.
It is. And the crucial application of all this knowledge for you, the listener, is recognizing that critical thinking is absolutely essential in assessing these conflicting global narratives. We learned today, for instance, that the U.S. tariffs aren't crushing the economy yet, primarily because this highly centralized stock market boom is generating a temporary wealth effect.
Right.
Conversely, China's drive for technological supremacy, funded by that $370 billion in state subsidies, is actually resulting in a massive, measurable loss of economic output due to misallocation and involution. You must look beyond the stated goal to the unintended structural consequence.
So what's the final thought you'd like to leave with the listener, connecting these deep themes of ideological control and economic efficiency?
Well, If, as the reports from Ukraine detailing the ideological basis of Russian torture and that pervasive Chinese grid management system illustrate, if autocracies are prioritizing ideology and absolute control over objective reality and economic efficiency, how long can their ambitious technological and economic goals truly be sustained against the messy, unpredictable forces of liberal democracy and market adaptation? China is already losing $370 billion annually to its own policies. Can ideology withstand economic reality indefinitely, especially when that reality is driven by global markets and the rule of law? That, I think, is the structural vulnerability we must watch in the coming years.
A deeply fascinating and provocative thought to end on. Thank you for guiding us through this complex material today.
My pleasure. Always enjoy it.
And thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the source material. We'll see you next time.